Governor Charlie Baker has been clear that robust contact tracing is critical to any plans for reopening. Massachusetts's program began 1 month ago, and since then, more than 1,200 tracers have been hired, and they've contacted more than 17,000 people. Now, their goal is to reach everyone who tests positive for the coronavirus, make sure they're in isolation, and then track and test all of their close contacts. So, success so far? And what issues does it raise? Joining us now on the line is John Welch. He is the Director of Partnerships and Operations for the Massachusetts COVID Response Project at Partners in Health. John, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
So Partners in Health is partnering with the Commonwealth on this contact tracing program. I want to start with the very latest numbers. Can you update us on how many people have been contacted as of, you know, like now, and how many contacts they've been in touch with?
Your numbers are pretty accurate. We're making close to 9,000 to 10,000 phone calls per day. Of course, not every single one of those results in a pickup, but the cases that are shared with us by local boards, we're reaching those each day,
While you're thinking there, let me just ask you a quick question, because sure. You used a term. You said not every one of those results in a pickup. I think what that means is not everyone picks up the phone. Is that what it means when you say results in a pickup?
That's right. Yep. We definitely have had better success over the last week or so. But one of the messages that we're trying to really get out there is if you receive a phone call from your local Board of Health or from the Mass COVID team, to go ahead and pick up that call. And we've got important information for you and really are trying to help you during this time.
So, John, I know you start with people who have tested positive for the virus and then reach out to close contacts. Can you define what a close contact is? What does that mean?
Yeah, certainly. So the Massachusetts DPH, as well as the CDC at the moment, are calling close contacts anyone that you've been within 6 feet of for 15 minutes or more.
And do you find people are willing to give you those names?
When we are able to help people understand what those close contacts are, and understand the importance of contact tracing, people are quite willing to cooperate. I think one of the important messages that we're also trying to share is just what an essential activity contact tracing is. To get to the end of an epidemic like this. And so once people understand what the activity is and that their information is safe with us, and that this is an activity that's really been carried out by boards of health for a very, very long time, then they're willing to cooperate and help us help them keep their community and their family safe.
So let's stay on that for just a second, John. Remind our listeners why contact tracing is an important strategy in, you know, avoiding prevention during a pandemic. Avoiding prevention, avoiding the disease or preventing the disease during a pandemic.
Sure. Yeah. Contact tracing has been around a very, very long time and is an essential activity of boards of health and public health officials around the state and around the country. And there are 90 different communicable diseases that contact tracing happens for every single day. During an epidemic, though, it becomes an essential tool, particularly when we're dealing with a virus that doesn't yet have a proven treatment and we haven't yet developed a vaccine. And so really the role of contact tracing is to break the chains of transmission. By that, I mean...
Well, so let me just ask you then, from there, what is the rate of pickup that you've been achieving here in the Commonwealth? What percentage of people that you're calling who are close contacts are picking up the phone, responding, and participating as you would want them to in the next steps, having heard from the Commonwealth?
Well, I'll start by saying that we don't give up easily. Folks are hearing maybe seeing our name on the caller ID, we do call people back pretty quickly, and just sort of leave them a voicemail, say, this is who we are. We just have some important information for you. And then we go ahead and try them back, a little while later. So, you know, of all of our phone calls, you know, we do wind up resulting in a pickup eventually. But if we look at all the phone calls in aggregate, around half of them result in a pickup. But that's, you know, important number to look at is just the volume of phone calls that we make, because we really, really do want to be in touch. And I guess I'll point out there, too, that, you know, if after this round of making phone calls and reaching out by text message isn't successful, we're right back in touch with the local Board of Health of where that individual might be living. And they are serving as our as the local experts in getting in touch with those folks that we might find hard to reach.
So that 50%-ish rate, you said around half, is that enough for the program to be successful? Understanding how core Governor Baker has consistently said contact tracing will be to a sustained reopening strategy that doesn't lead to huge spikes in the virus again. Is that rate going to get it done?
So again, you know, that pickup rate is an aggregate sort of number looking at all the phone calls that we make. And what's great to say is that the cases that we receive, we've been able to make outreach to a large majority of those people. It just takes some effort. You know, one of the contact tracers shared a story that, following this protocol we have in place of making a couple of phone calls and leaving a message, finally on an additional attempt, the person finally answered the phone and said, you know, this must be Sarah, and just explained that, you know, they were otherwise occupied and actually were quite happy to talk. So, you know, that rate is for all of the phone calls that we make, and we were able to say those cases that we receive to make that outreach to, by and large, we're able to reach them. It just takes some effort. And so that's why continuing to share the message of answering the call.
Let's say that contact tracer Sarah gets a hold of me. She calls me because I have tested positive or I have been in close contact with somebody who has tested positive. What information is she offering and what services is she telling me about?
Sure. So, you know, it's important that we sort of differentiate the two activities of case investigation, which is, you know, speaking with an individual who's tested positive, and then the activity of contact tracing. In the first instance, you know, Sarah would be, number one, making sure she's got the right person on the line. We want to be sure that everything is maintaining privacy and security. And so she'll make sure she's got the right person, and then really wants to make sure you're doing okay. You know, this is active outreach, and wants to make sure that if, for example, maybe you're feeling a little worse since your test results came, that you're able to speak with your provider or, you know, other emergency services. So that's important to us as well. And then explaining what isolation for someone who's tested positive for COVID is, and making sure you've got what you need to safely isolate. And, you know, those are
things
like... What
does that mean? Like, is that like grocery? Yeah.
Yeah, great question. Yeah, it's groceries. It's, you know, perhaps your prescription is going to run out sometime during your isolation period. It can be any type of social support. And I'll just say that, you know, it's nice to be in a state like Massachusetts where so many of these services exist, and really the role then of the resource coordination during contact tracing is to make sure that people are connected to those services that already exist. And so then after those activities happen, Sarah would go ahead and start helping you think through who those close contacts have been, and helping you think through even 48 hours before you started to have symptoms, who your close contacts were, trying to draw out
their names. Right there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I want to stop you there for a second. I apologize for interrupting, but I want to make sure we get to this. That marks a shift in the phone call. And I can completely imagine how a person receiving the call with support and services, and here's how we help you isolate. I understand that. I have to imagine that there are trust and privacy issues that come up when it comes to the second half of what you're talking about.
Absolutely. And that's why conversations like this are just so important for folks to understand really what an essential activity contact tracing is. And also as a reassurance that, you know, all of this information is kept secure and private, and that same as any sort of public health official, public health nurse, or health agent, you know, this activity is really an effort to break the chain of transmission by informing a close contact that they're at risk, and that they have the information and the knowledge to try and quarantine and stay away from others, and keep a close eye on symptoms for COVID. It's 2 weeks. And I should point out too that while that the person who is tested positive for COVID is sharing this contact information with us, we never share the identity of that positive case with the contacts. We do encourage.
So if you reach out to people I've been in close contact with after I test positive, you do not tell them in that outreach that I am the person who tested positive and supplied them with the names and contact information?
Correct. Correct. We do encourage that case. You know, if you know these individuals and you feel comfortable, it's worth sharing your news with them if you're comfortable with that. And that's just another mechanism by which people understand, gosh, I'm at risk. And now I have some power and some information to try and break the chain of transmission.
So, John, in our last little bit of time here, as we said at the beginning, this is key to the Massachusetts plan for reopening. So I want to ask you, what's next here in the Commonwealth in terms of contact tracing?
Sure. You know, so the Community Tracing Collaborative will continue to work closely with local boards of health. You know, again, this is an activity that they've provided for a very long time, and will continue to provide after the Community Tracing Collaborative's is no longer. And so we're really here as a backstop, as a way to fill in, to provide this kind of surge capacity, so those local boards can continue their essential activities. And in so doing, we'll be here as long as Governor Baker and Secretary Sutters feels that an initiative like this is needed in the Commonwealth. And be here for the citizens of Massachusetts.
John Welch is the Director of Partnerships and Operations for the Massachusetts COVID Response Project at Partners in Health. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The coronavirus pandemic wasn't the first financial challenge for Pine Manor College in Chestnut Hill, but it didn't help. Pine Manor announced yesterday that it will be forming an educational partnership with Boston College, with BC set to take on all of Pine Manor's assets and liabilities, and current Pine Manor students being taught out over the next 2 years. This is one of what is anticipated to be a number of changes, mergers, closings for small colleges and universities in the next few years. Joining us now is the president of Pine Manor College, Thomas O'Reilly. Tom, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana. Glad to be here.
And Tom, I should mention before we jump in, just so listeners know, I did serve as a faculty member at Boston College for a number of years. So, Tom, I want to start with the why. Why did Pine Manor College find itself in a situation where this kind of change was necessary?
Well, Tiziana, Pine Manor College has always had three things that it cared about deeply: our students, our people, and our mission. And we, like many not-for-profit organizations, we've always been financially fragile. And we've been very clear about that to our student community, our people community, our faculty and staff, the community we serve, and the public in general. And we always said that our goal was to make sure that we delivered the absolute best outcomes for our students, our people, and our mission. And that to do that, we're going to have to look at many different ways to see what was possible to have a pathway forward. And when the world changed so dramatically, it heightened the opportunity to look out and see what else could we do, what could be the next Pine Manor College version 2, and deliver in the same good way for students, the same good way for our people, and the same good way for the important mission we hold. So that's what happened.
So what made BC the right choice? What made this particular arrangement the right thing to do next?
Well, you know, over the years, I've talked to many college presidents and many other entities about what might make sense in order to best further the mission of Pine Manor College. And President Leahy and I have had conversations over the years about what the possibilities might be, as have a number of other folks. And here, the thing that was easy to hone in on is the shared set of values and the shared mission. You know, Boston College was founded as an immigrant college, a place where the first generation people of their time, of that time, went to college. It was a commuter school. It was a place where new immigrants got their first opportunity to step up. Today, that's what Pine Manor College is. It's a place where the traditionally underserved, traditionally underrepresented have a chance to get in on the next set opportunity in life. And what we found was that there was a deep connection on what that mission was all about for both of us. And it made it easy to talk about everything else. So
Tom,
it was a natural fit.
So Tom, Pine Manor has focused extensively on low-income first-generation students. I know that in 2018, students of color and international students made up 93% of Pine Manor's enrollment. Are you worried, with BC being a private, fairly expensive institution, are you worried about that continuing?
Well, I'm not worried about it. What I see is opportunity. I mean, we can look at every situation and say, oh my goodness, do I have to worry? Or we can say, oh my goodness, look at that opportunity. And I think that's how we focus at it. You know, Boston College is only one of 20 universities in the country that takes a needs-blind approach to admissions. It lets in anyone for whom they believe they can be a good fit and serve. And what they're asking us to do, they looked at what working at Pine Manor College, and they saw the student success model that they said, wow, look what they are doing and look what's happening. What if we could bring ourselves together and be able to expand and accelerate that type of opportunity for young people? And that's what we've agreed to, that we're going to bring Pine Manor College through the institute that's been talked about, that's been articulated, to give Boston College this strength, this additional power in serving a traditionally underrepresented community. So I think good intentions, good people, lots of resources make it possible.
So let's talk about that a little bit more. I know you know that BC has had a number of well-known, well-reported episodes of some serious racial strife and student protest on the campus in the last few years. Does Pine Manor bring skill sets and abilities to BC that it didn't have before? And or are you concerned about BC institutionally having the skill sets it needs to serve the specific needs of Pine Manor students?
Well, I think that all of us with good intentions, all of us who come to the table trying to do the right thing, are open to hearing new and other ways to do it. I was totally impressed by President Leahy when all of his questions were about how does it work? How is it that you deliver on your mission? Why is it that you deliver on your mission? And he knew right away that finding another ally in the work that BC's already been trying to do would be tremendously helpful to expanding and accelerating that. So I think there's a will. And where there's a will, there's a way.
We're in the middle of a pandemic, and Pine Manor, through this arrangement, will be teaching out students for the next 2 years. As you start to think about the fall, how are you thinking about that? Are you looking exclusively at online classes? Are you planning to have students back on campus? Do you know yet?
I don't know that any college knows what the future holds in that regard. It's pretty amazing. It's a terrible situation to have such low visibility to the future. Every college in America is struggling with, can we open? How will we open? What will it look like? Well, I'll tell you this, Pine Manor College had no likelihood of being able to open in the fall before Boston College stepped in. And now we have a partner who says, what you do is important. We want to help you do it, and we're here to back you. So while I don't know exactly what the fall will look like, I do know that we'll be running classes and students will continue in their education. And that wasn't possible before Boston College stepped in.
Tom, what are you hearing from students and alumni about this?
I have never received so many letters, emails, phone calls of unexaggerated excitement about this. I have gotten messages from the leaders of the town of Brookline. This is the best thing we've seen. I've gotten calls from alums who I've never met who said this is a good thing. I've talked to students first thing this morning to say, what do you think? And they say, well, if you say it's good, I believe in you. They're such a terrific group of people. And I think it's the best we can give them. The faculty and staff are delighted. You know, so often in life, and especially in a time like this, in a major pandemic, when people are losing jobs left and right, where everything is being upended, we have a hugely powerful institution saying, what you're doing is important, and we want to keep it going. That is an incredible message. We don't want you to fail. We want to find a way to progress forward what you've been doing. I'm just amazed.
Tom, I know you're aware that there's a lot of concern about the health of small colleges and universities, and many of them serve the kinds of alums, the kinds of students that Pine Manor serves. What do you say to alums and first-time students, low-income students, who are saddened that this was a model that couldn't sustain in this marketplace for higher education?
Well, I think what colleges offer, every college is different. And I think that what's very important for every institution to do from the institution side is to make sure that they're really offering something unique and special. That's true for any type of business, organization, not-for-profit. If you're not filling an important need, then you're not going to see the outcomes that you want, and it's not going to be able to be something that you can go forward with on your own. I think in the case of Pine Manor College, we were able to show folks that we were doing something very special and we were very successful at it, so it was worth investing in. I think that what we all have to do is take stock that life will continue to change and evolve. And what those of us in education have to do is make sure that young people know that what we're trying to do is prepare them for life, not just for tomorrow, but for life. And if we do the right things and give them the right skills, they will weather through it all and they will be successful. You know, life is not always a bowl of cherries and everything good comes by. What we have to do is know how to proceed in a way that's successful, even when things go bad. You know, my team at the college know that I often quote what we jokingly refer to as a famous Latin rapper. His name was Cicero. And Cicero, in defending the new way that people were educating, the Romans and the Greeks were coming together, and the Greeks had this idea of liberal education, and the Romans had this idea of functional education. And Cicero, in defending the liberal education, said, these pursuits, meaning the pursuit of education, these pursuits nourish youth, delight old age, embellish prosperity, afford a refuge and a comfort in adversity. Well, if those of us who are in education, particularly higher education, are doing our job, that's what will happen. Our young people will be prepared for adversity. They'll be prepared for the enjoyments that come their way. They'll grow and they'll strengthen and be able to weather the ups and downs of life. Most people I know don't have smooth sailing every day.
That's a strong point. And that's Tom O'Reilly, president of Pine Manor College. Tom, thanks for the time today.
Thank you, Tiziana. Always good to talk to you.
You too, Tom. Listening into that conversation was WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin. Max, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So let me just start with thoughts and reactions to what you just heard from Tom O'Reilly.
I think you heard a characteristic candor that belongs to both President O'Reilly and the institution. So he said, we had no likelihood of being open in the fall. In other words, we were sunk by coronavirus mainly, if this kind of life raft doesn't come in. They always kind of wore that financial fragility he mentioned on their collective sleeve. But then again, they have this vivid sense of mission. And I think you got that too, you know, this sort of close support, intimacy, familiarity with students, a little tight-knit community of students who are often, you know, the first in their family to go to college. But I guess my...
Max, Tom... Well, I just want to ask, because the pandemic closed them, but Tom was clear at the beginning of that conversation that there'd been a longer-term financial health issue there, right?
Yeah, I think you have to think of Pine Manor as kind of an underdog college, Tiziana. For most of their century plus of existence, it was a white women's college offering two-year degrees, not exclusively, but predominantly. And then by the 1990s, that model just didn't make a ton of sense, I think, to the consumer of higher ed, namely the applicant, and enrollment crashes. So they make this pivot, both in the name of business and in the name of mission. They're going to serve kids who've been left out of higher education, like first-generation students. They go co-ed. But all throughout, enrollment was really, really low. You've got a few hundred students, and many of those might leave mid-year for work or family reasons. They might drop out. They might transfer out. And yet, Pine Manor seemed to be figuring it out a little bit. They sold off a bit of their campus sort of famously to no less a buyer than Tom Brady, back when he was a Patriot still living in Brookline. And they started to recruit nationally and they built up alternative revenue streams. They had a childcare program, they had wedding rentals. And so they were doing okay, but the pandemic meant that all those little short-term ingenuities finally got swamped under the long-term structural issues they've been facing.
Max, they had valuable land and a valuable location, and also the other assets that you talked about. What do you make of BC's interest in the school and those various assets?
Yeah, I think there is part of this that you have to say is a land deal. Pine Manor has this lovely campus with a mansion on it, trees. It's about a mile and a half from the center of BC's campus. And so this is a chance to expand. You've already got academic buildings on the site. But I think there's something to this idea of Pine Manor being, you know, finding version 2.0 with BC, which has always served at least some share of students who are, you know, left out, you know, as Catholic immigrants a while ago. And now they think they do quite well with Pell eligible students who are low income. I think just a lot of this depends, Tiziana, on the good faith of BC. You know, are staff going to come over? Will there be room for, you know, Pine Manor's mission to express itself institutionally? You know, we don't really have concrete details on the nature of the deal and how it will play out over the next 2 years.
In our last minute or so, Max, prior to the pandemic, we had talked a lot about small liberal arts colleges being at risk of closing. Obviously, the pandemic creates greater financial risk for all kinds of institutions. Are you expecting this to be the beginning of more of these kinds of closings and mergers?
Yeah, it's been now 2 years since Mount Ida College closed in Newton, and that clearly gave whiplash to students and staff and state regulators. And all the forces that made that happen are still out there affecting colleges in different ways. Long-term enrollment decline, changing wishes for families. But the virus seems almost tailor-made to strain those colleges, particularly small colleges, even further. I think it's really hard to predict what colleges may close and why. It's a really diverse system, but I don't think anyone would be surprised if there's trouble ahead in this sector. The hope is only that other schools find a solution that's at least as good as the one that Pine Manor has found here with BC.
Well, Max, we're going to continue to watch your reporting on that. That's Max Larkin, WBUR Edify reporter. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Been watching many movies? We are nearing 2 months since Governor Baker first issued the stay-at-home advisory for Massachusetts. That is a lot of time stuck at home. The same four walls, sometimes with the same few people. Movies can be a great escape, to a point. Take it from one of my favorite classics. It's a 1954 Alfred Hitchcock film about a man confined to his home, not by a pandemic, but a broken leg. And the only thing to pass the time is looking out the window.
I wonder if it's ethical to watch a man with binoculars and a long focus lens. Do you suppose it's ethical even if you prove that he didn't commit a crime?
I'm not much on Rear Window ethics.
Now that was, of course, Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly in Rear Window. And joining me now to talk about it and other great movies about being stuck at home is Ty Burr, film critic for the Boston Globe. Welcome, Ty.
Thanks, Tiziana.
And we want you to join the conversation. Have you been watching a lot of movies while you're stuck at home? What have you been watching? And have you seen any great movies about being stuck at home or within some space or in isolation? Share your favorites with us. Join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So Ty, you made a list. I was hoping Rear Window was going to be on it. It was. Why is this the perfect film? Yeah, that's right. Why is it so great for those being stuck inside?
Well, because it literalizes being stuck inside. He's got a broken leg. From a cast from his ankle to his hip. He can't go anywhere. It's not like, you know, he could step outside and walk the dog if he wanted. He is stuck there. And he's stuck there. Oh, dear me. He's stuck there with Grace Kelly, who wants to marry him. And
looking
crazy Jimmy Stewart.
Fabulous in every
Absolutely.
Scene, by the way, Ty.
Right.
She's nuts. Yeah.
Right. And one of the many great things about that movie is that as he stares across the courtyard and looks at all the people in all the apartments, each one represents a kind of movie reflecting his anxieties about being married or being left alone or, you know, all the things that are going through his head, they're all there. And of course, one of them is about a wife killer.
Of course, which I'm just going to laugh at that theme because I imagine there are plenty of people who have been stuck inside with people they love very much over the last couple months who have thought a couple of times, man, I don't like you so much anymore.
Man, well,
so,
know,
okay, so we're...
Day after day, day after day, what we're learning is you're renegotiating pretty much close quarters living on an ongoing basis.
That's right. That's right. Ty, we're really used to these big sweeping movies now. Epics. And I mean, we don't even need to be contained to the planet anymore, let alone one room. So what does a movie need in order to make it work in these little single settings?
It needs tension, the tension of the setup. Or it needs the tension of the people who are stuck in that room. It needs conflict. And that's actually, you know, it's drama boiled down to its essence. You know, we were talking about putting on the list 12 Angry Men, which is the classic jury movie about 12 men stuck in a sweltering Brooklyn courthouse room, trying to decide whether a boy is guilty of killing his father. And of course, you've got
Wait right there for a second before you make that point, because we have some sound from that. Let me let our listeners hear it. This is from 1957, 12 Angry Men.
Guilty. 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 Not guilty. Guilty. Boy, how do you like that?
Oh, another chap flips his wings.
All right. Who was it? Come on, I want to know.
Excuse me, this was a secret ballot. We all agreed on that, no? If the gentleman wanted to remain secret...
Secret? What do you mean, secret? There are no secrets in a jury room. I know who it was.
All right, take it from there, Ty.
Well, I mean, the great thing about that movie is you've got this cross-section of human types. Of course, all men. It is 12 Angry Men. But all classes, all types, not all races, some ethnicities. I mean, it's a 1950s movie, and so reflective of its time. But the great thing about it is they can't leave that room. It plays out in real time. And the drama of it is eventually each character's true self will reveal itself. And that's the tension of the, and also the tension of how they're going to resolve this criminal case. But really, it's about personality. And the greatest single room movies are about clashing personalities. You can't get away from each other. It's Sartre. It's no exit.
Well, it also, we've got some calls. I'm going to go to a call in just a second, but I do want to say it also reminds me of what you just jokingly said to my comment about people kind of being done with each other. It does show how people have to renegotiate their relationships with each other over time. Let's pick up a call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Bob on the line from Fall River. Hey there, Bob.
Oh, good afternoon.
Hi, Bob.
The movie I think of is Rope.
Yes.
Which also starred Jimmy Stewart, along with Folly Granger and John Dahl. It reminds one of Leopold and Loeb, the two geniuses who decide to commit the perfect crime, and after secreting the body in a chest, use the chest as a drinks bar and have a party over them. And Jimmy Stewart eventually breaks them down. He plays the professor in that particular movie. It's all shot, I think, from one or two camera angles, too. It was very tight and
it's
very
excellent.
Claustrophobic.
Thanks for that, Bob. That's awesome. And Ty, I think that was on your sort of list of candidates, right? I think
well,
you agree with Bob on that one.
Hitchcock went back to this idea three times, between Rear Window, Rope, which takes place in one room. And as Bob pointed out, it's actually shot in one continuous camera move, or what appears to be one continuous camera move. So it never leaves the room, the apartment. And then there's Lifeboat, which is, talk about conflicting personalities stuck on a lifeboat in the middle of the ocean. It's a room. It's just a big open air room.
So let's take one more call here, and then I've got some more movies and some more sound I want to do with you, Ty. We've got Vivian on the line. Well, let me throw the number out again. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, I've got Vivian on the line from Medford. Vivian, you're up.
Hey, Ty. This is Vivian, your old neighbor from Newton.
Hi, Vivian.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. When I was a teenager, I used to go to all of the free films at Wesleyan University. The Wednesday night ones were the most obscure. And I went to see a film called L'Amour Fou. And it was about 4 hours long. And actually, my father was sent over to fetch me because it was a school night. And they didn't expect it to go on that long. But it took place. It was real time. Of a marriage disintegrating, and it took place entirely in the bedroom of this couple, and they just kind of hash it out and go back and forth between, you know, being passionate and being infuriated with one another, and then they're tearing the wallpaper off the wall. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do. And in fact, it's directed by one of my favorite directors, Jacques Rivette, who I don't think ever made a movie that was shorter than 3 hours long. And he made one that's actually 12 hours long. Talk about being stuck in a room with that. And I haven't seen L'Amour Fou. I've seen a lot of his films are hard to see. So you count yourself lucky, I guess, that you were able to see that one. They aren't shown very often, but they are intense, and they do put people in close quarters and with very strange things happening.
So Ty, let's riff off of Vivian's theme for a minute, because another movie that you suggested kind of in the list as we were getting ready for this segment was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Which is a play turned into a movie, 1966, Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. They play George and Martha. They're a heavy drinking couple who invite over a younger couple. Here's just a little bit of their back and forth as they prepare themselves another drink and to prepare for their guests.
I gave you the prize years ago, Martha. There isn't an abomination award going that you haven't won.
I swear if you existed, I'd divorce you.
And just stay on your feet, that's all. These people are your guests.
I can't even see you.
If you pass out,
I haven't been able to see you for years.
I try to keep your clothes on, too. There aren't many more sickening sights in this world than you with a couple of drinks and you and your skirt up over your head.
A zero.
Your heads, I should say.
Party!
Oh, I'm really looking forward to this, Martha.
Oh, my gosh, Ty.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I imagine that some people are listening to this after 3 months of close quarters and thinking, why pay for what I can get at home for free?
Sorry.
They actually
really?
Do go outside that? In that movie. They do go outside. I think they go to a bar. There's a big screaming match in a parking lot. But, yes, it is about people who've been together in one house for far too long.
And what about that, Ty? You know, Do we want to watch movies that reflect kind of where we are when we're in those moments? Or do we like to watch movies that are someplace very different than the situation or life that we find ourselves in? What's your experience?
I think we want both, depending on the time. I mean, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is so brilliantly written by Edward Albee and so incredibly well played by Burton and Taylor and George Segal and Sandy Dennis that it's a heightened version of some of the crap that we go through in our own lives, but it's heightened, it's operatic, it's epic, even though it's at close quarters. It makes us, it's almost iconic, legendary. It's our small problems writ large. And that's can be fascinating to watch.
Do you know, were they married at the time, Burton and Taylor? Because
yes,
weren't
they
married?
They were.
And they were married at the time?
They made a number of movies together. Most of them are terrible. This one's probably the best of the bunch.
Interesting. Let's take another call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Joseph on the line from Worcester. Joseph, what film's on your mind?
Oh, hi. You just got me with a mouthful of sandwich.
happens to me all the time, Joseph.
I was wondering if, speaking of this type of movie, if No Exit has ever been, you know, made into a film.
That's a
good
film, question.
The story No Exit?
That's a good question. I'm going to look it up right now, if you don't mind.
I don't mind. So, and Joseph, tell us just a little, now that you've swallowed your sandwich, tell us just a little bit about what the story is about while Ty's checking that out.
Oh, three people trapped in a place that they're not sure where it is together. And they create their personalities are so different and clash so much that they create an impossible situation where each of them only wishes they could escape that situation. And it turns out that they're in hell, so they've been... That we kind of create our own hell is the premise of the book.
Well, that is fascinating. Let's turn back to Ty and see what he's found.
Joseph,
out.
What'd
you find, Ty?
I'm cheating. I'm going to the Internet Movie Database here, and I'm finding it's been made a number of times. It was actually made back in 1954 in France. It's been made in the 60s in England. There's a bunch of short versions of it. There was a TV movie version of it in 2017. And I'm not sure which country. So it is clearly, I think it's the litmus, rather it's the baseline version of the hell is other people stuck in a room story. And so it's the blueprint. So I think that people feel that they can go back to it over and over again.
So let's take another call because we've got Vicky on the line from Danvers and she wants to talk about one that is another favorite of the classics for me. Vicky, bring it up.
Hi there. Actually, I'm from Newton. My last name is
Danvers. Oh, okay.
That's okay.
All right.
I wanted to describe Wait Until Dark with Audrey Hepburn and Alan Arkin. Now, I don't remember. It was a long time ago, and I don't remember all of it. But what I remember is most of the movie takes place in one room in her apartment, and Alan Arkin is the villain. And he is trying to kill her. And she's blind. And she has a cane. And he gets into her apartment. And she runs around realizing that since it's dark out, if she can smash all the light bulbs in her apartment and she knows where all of them are, then she'll be on the same footing with him. And so the tension is her... running around, getting behind the sofa and running over and smashing this lamp. And then he tries to come another way behind the sofa and she runs across the room and she smashes another light bulb. And then she gets the last light bulb and it's dark and he can't see her anymore. And she knows that she has a better chance of getting out. And then the last piece
wait attention. No, don't tell the end, don't tell the end, you can't tell the end, Vicky.
Okay,
I think you've sold a lot of people on this movie.
Do you remember, Vicky?
Ty, go ahead,
the bad guys are after? And it's not only Alan Arkin, evil Alan Arkin. I mean, you've never seen an evil Alan Arkin before. The other bad guys are Jack Weston and Richard Crenna. They're all very young. But do you remember what they're after? They're after a doll with heroin inside it that somehow, I forget how, has gotten into her apartment.
Oh, yes, I remember that. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's great.
And there's one, I won't tell the end, but there's one more piece that you've got to know, and that is that she has forgotten about one light, and it's the light in the refrigerator.
Right.
And he opens the refrigerator door, okay? And then, okay, so I won't tell any more after that.
Don't tell any more. But Vicky, that was a treat. And I actually had goosebumps while you were reminding me of that. I mean, Audrey Hepburn is such a tour de force anyway. What a great film. Do you remember who made that one?
Terence Young, a British director named Terence Young. He was produced by Hepburn's husband, Mel Ferrer, and Henry Mancini wrote the movie, wrote the music. It's very much of its time. I think that's actually a good at-home game for when you're getting bored. Turn off all the lights, pretend you're Audrey Hepburn and wait until dark and, you know, just feel your way around the apartment and have somebody try and, like, tackle you.
But don't forget the refrigerator if you do.
Right, exactly.
All right, we got another call, 1-800-423-8255. We've got Ed on the line from Reading. I think he's going to be our last call, so let's hear what he has to say. Go ahead, Ed.
Well, there are two movies that I was thinking of, and they're not in a room, but The Old Man and the Sea is what you see is the movie, the sea and the boat and the fish and all of that, which I thought was a great movie. And the other one is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm. Oh, both fantastic movies. Thank you for those, Ed. And boats are a genre of isolation, right, Ty?
Right, absolutely. And Old Man of the Sea makes me think of that Robert Redford movie of recent years, All Is Lost, which is, again, a man on a boat in the middle of the sea, and it's as elemental as it gets. And One
makes
Flew
me
over
think
the
of Life of Pi as well.
Right, exactly. And One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is, well, they can't leave. They're stuck in a room with Nurse Ratched, which may be the most horrible thing of all.
Well, and doesn't she just kind of, I mean, in several of these movies we've been talking about, Ty, in our last minute or so, we're talking about performances that are just off the hook as well. And how much of a difference does that make in the ability to tell such a big story in such a small space?
Oh, I think it absolutely matters. I was thinking one we didn't get to yet. It was a more recent movie, that Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight, in which he just, it's eight incredible hambone actors stuck in a shack in the middle of the winter, and they can't get out, and they're all out acting each other. And it's Sam Jackson Jr. And Bruce Dern. And, you know, it's hilarious for just the taking this idea of people stranded in a room where they can't get away from each other to the utmost of Tarantino-ness.
So Ty, what I'm going to do is thank you there. And then I think we're going to try to get some sound from that movie. So that's Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. Ty, this was a blast. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Take care.
If I die in the next 2 days, which is more than likely, you're going to have me. Under the name of English Pete Hickox, I got a federal bounty of $15,000 on my head. It's all yours, Chris.
You keep talking, Pete. You're going to talk yourself to death.
There you go. That's our show for today.